You're listening to the Yacht Racing Life Podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, and this week my guest is British Olympic gold medalist and America's Cup sailor, Paul Goodison, who returns for his second appearance on the podcast. Paul will need very little introduction to most of you. He is an Olympic gold medal winner in the laser class, a three-time Moth World champion, and a veteran now of three America's Cup campaigns, the latest of which was his second go-around with the New York Yacht Club's American Magic Syndicate, at the 37th Cup in Barcelona last year. Sadly, things didn't go as planned for him. A serious accident aboard the American AC-75 after racing early in the competition, in which he broke five ribs, ruled him out of any further participation. Despite this setback, he was soon back at the American Magic base doing whatever he could to help the team's progress through the Louis Vuitton Cup Challenger Series. During our interview, Paul gives some fantastic insider insight into the American Magic Barcelona campaign, but I began by getting an update on his recovery and asking him to explain exactly how the accident happened. So Paul, let me start by asking you how you are after that incident, that accident during AC-37 with American Magic. How are the ribs?
It's taken a while to feel back to normal, but luckily I can say it feels like it's almost fixed and feeling almost 100%. Still a little bit of pain at times doing certain stuff, but it's kind of the back of my mind now and forgotten about it and moving on. It doesn't really stop me doing too much. Lucky enough, I was out skiing, I've been out winging, so it hurts a little bit, but it's not holding me back.
It was a pretty serious incident and it put you out of the cup. I think you damaged five ribs. What can you tell us?
Yeah, it was a funny one. Like we just finished racing against the French. And we'd won the race, but obviously we hadn't sailed probably as good as what we'd hoped to. It was pretty top end conditions and we were a little bit on edge at times. And it was kind of just a bit of a relief that we'd won the race and qualified for the semifinals. But we'd finished and the boat was overheating. So everybody was whipping the hatches off as soon as we stopped to try and cool things downstairs. And then we dropped the sails just like any normal day to get ready to tow in. But then as it came to towing back in, the mainsail was over Andrew's cockpit, who was going to fly the boat home. So we basically just lifting the mainsail across out of the way so he could get into his cockpit. And I unfortunately went through the hatch. I ended up laying in the bottom of the boat unconscious and struggling for breath. So it was a big hit and a bit of a shock, but kind of at the time it was more shock than anything. I didn't really realize what had happened. Obviously quite a lot of pain, but the medic was on there quickly to try and help me out, and I don't know what it was, but he put something under my tongue and I felt pretty good pretty quickly. But then it was a bit of a tedious journey back in. I had to go back in on laying in the front of the rib all the way back to shore, bouncing about, and I could tell you I've never felt every wave quite as much in my whole life as I did as the trip back to shore, and then off to hospital. And after maybe half an hour of getting scans and seeing doctors, it became pretty apparent that it was probably going to be the end of my racing, which was obviously just devastating. I got told I'd got five broken ribs and wasn't going to be able to do much for a while, unfortunately. So at the time, it was obviously heartbreaking and pretty upsetting, but it's one of those accidents that happens, and unfortunately, it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, what a surprise. I think it took everybody by complete surprise. We were used to stuff happening, but that came kind of right out of the blue. And I'm guessing, I'm just thinking back to your Olympic time in 2012 in London, where you had a back injury that kind of put you out of contention then. Did you think back to that time?
No, I didn't actually. Like the London incident, I could get out there and try, if you know what I mean. And I think what was the hardest thing about the accident in Barcelona was that there wasn't really much of an option to get out there and try. There's high risk of me puncturing a lung or damaging my liver if I tried to do anything. So that was, I guess, the hardest thing to deal with. And just at the time, it was just heartbroken that all the effort and all the opportunity that was there to capitalize on had slipped away, not just from me, but it felt like the team a little bit as well.
You were hospitalized for at least a few days, I think, but then you managed to kind of get back with the team. What sort of role did you play with the team at that point?
It was hard for me because obviously I wanted to be there and I wanted to, I was still kind of hoping at some point that the guys could keep ticking away and keep us in it and that I'd have a chance a couple of weeks down the line to get back, however that might be, and race again. So I was desperate to help the team from a personal level, but also from a team level. You see the guys breaking themselves day in, day out to get the boat out sailing and to give us the opportunity. So I desperately wanted to be part of it. And I ended up going, I think it was like, well, I actually weighed in for the semifinals. That was probably another one of the most painful trips in my life. I think my wife found every speed bump on the way into the bay from the house or every crack in the road, because I definitely felt it. But I weighed in a little heavier than my target weight was, as I'd been laying on my back for 4 or 5 days doing nothing. But I weighed in, and then the thing was whatever I could do to help. So there's a big part trying to help Lucas get up to speed, sitting with him in the simulator. And then as it came to the racing, I was sat up in the Matt Frey building, I think like the 25th or 26th floor, basically being the eyes in the sky, looking for wind and communicating with the guys to try and help them from up there.
It must have been great to be contributing to the whole thing, but it must have been painful, you know, not being out. I know what a competitor you are, so that must have been really difficult. A few words about Lucas, and you know, he's like that movie quarterback that gets the call up from the bench when it's completely unexpected, right?
Yeah, no, Lucas had done quite a lot of sailing with us while Tom had been away at SailGP each time, so we could keep the 75 program rolling. So he'd had the time, but he hadn't had the race practice, and he did a pretty good job, to be honest, from where he was to race as well as the guys did.
Okay, let's talk about the campaign itself, your second campaign with American Magic. The previous time you were trimming mainsheet, Dean Barker was steering the boat. This time you stepped up, obviously, into the helmsman role. Was that a big step up? Was that something you were, was a criteria of you rejoining the team?
Terry approached me after, it always takes a while after each cycle's finished before the rules are determined and what's basically going to happen. And Terry approached me and asked me if I'd join them and lead the team helming. And it was a fantastic opportunity to get back with a group of people that I knew really well and a team that really felt like a bigger family. So it was an obvious decision to join up and to get my teeth back into things with American Magic.
I remember you were a guest on the podcast during that cup down in Auckland, and I think you said that you did some helming on Patriot down there as a kind of backup role.
Yeah, no, we did with Dean and myself. Dean obviously was the primary helm, but when he wasn't available at times during the campaign, then I'd stay up. And I'd done a reasonable amount of driving of the 75 back in the autumn campaign.
So AC36 was pretty tumultuous for American Magic, and people will generally remember it for the big skyrocket and the crash and the almost sinking. But when I look back on that campaign, I remember lots of potential from it. I remember before Christmas thinking you guys were really slick and really fast. And looked like you had lots of potential.
Yeah.
Something seemed to go backwards a little bit over the Christmas break, and you never looked to me as flash again. Am I right? Or
yeah, I think you're right in a little way. But like all of these cycles, it's about who can develop their equipment the most. You see, when the boats first launched this time and last time round, that the people that are fastest straight away at launch time weren't necessarily the guys who were in the final or in the America's Cup. And it's definitely a game of development. And I think I look back to Auckland and we were probably one of the better teams at sailing the boat in the Christmas Cup. And the boat was pretty well already developed. And we just didn't have enough new things coming on board or didn't have a good enough design strategy to keep developing and keep getting the boat faster. The boat obviously had its inherent weaknesses. Like the thing wasn't very good at getting out of the water. And that was always a struggle and something you try and mode against. But as soon as you're trying to mode one way to help it, in one condition, it obviously you take away from what it's very good at. And it's just one of those things where we didn't quite get the design as spot on as we needed to do for those light winds. And we always expected it to be a bit breezier down in Auckland. And unfortunately, the racing that we mainly did ended up being never like this sort of conditions.
Hi, everybody. Justin Chisholm here with a quick message. We do hope you're enjoying this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. And we wanted you to know that you can get more great content from around the world of sailboat racing on the Yacht Racing Life website, where there's plenty of free content to check out, and premium subscribers get all areas access to the site. Head over to yachtracinglife.com/YRL pod for a lifetime 50% off the regular monthly premium subscription price. Yeah, and in that race where you had the crash, it was windy and you were out running the Italians kind of reasonably comfortably.
Yeah.
All right. So when you rejoined the team, at what stage of development were they? Were you in right at the beginning of the whole thing and able to influence the campaign, or did you join after some decisions have been made?
No, I was in pretty early this time around. Obviously, they needed some experience from the sailing last time. Terry was heading the team up. He had some experience from sailing on board, but then myself and Andrew Campbell were the early ones in who had the experience from the previous cup. And I remember the first meetings we had about the design philosophy and where we wanted to be with this boat and being very much part of that. And I think the decisions we made very early on put us in a reasonably good position to have a chance this time around.
Can you expand on what those decisions were? What sort of things do you mean?
You just have to basically decide what you want to target the boat at, what weather conditions, how hard you push for getting the boat out of the water, how hard you push on some of the foil sizing. But that some of the initial decisions are just the design philosophy of which part of the spectrum you want to aim the boat at. And then as you start from there, it's more about, okay, now you're fine tuning, okay, now watch the foil size. Because a lot of the initial decisions on the hull shape, sizes, and determine how quick the boat's going to get out of the water and what other things you can then get away with after that.
And you feel those decisions were good decisions now, looking back on it in retrospect?
I think you look back at all the boats and they're all a little bit different. Ours was obviously a bit of an outlier, and we decided to push hard into that space of the low area, less windage sort of strategy. And the boat was extremely good in the wavy conditions, which is something we targeted very well. And I think the boat was fast and able to compete with all of them. And I think on its day, it could have easily have been right there at the end. I think what most people kind of miss is how important the foils are. It's like 78% of the drag is just in the foil. So as much as the glaringly obvious difference in the hulls, the bits that make the difference are always the appendages and the underwater. And you look back and maybe we're a little bit conservative in one or two areas when you look at the opposition, but it's a bit of a risk reward. And again, we gave ourselves the opportunity that if we'd have sailed the boat well, we'd have been in there with a chance.
There was a point when I interviewed you after racing during the cup where you talked a bit about the balance, the risk reward between the sailability of the boat, kind of ease of sailing the boat and versus performance. You seem to be suggesting maybe you need to make the boat slightly easier to sail and sacrifice a bit of performance, because there were times when it seemed like a struggle just to, especially in the really light stuff.
There's definitely a big balance between the performance side and the sailability side of the boat. And one of our big design focuses was for the waves. So we were set up maybe a little bit more forgiving. And then we had a lot of the components coming online, like appendages, rudders, that were a lot harder to sail than what we're used to. And And the way it works with the round robins, a lot of these components are coming on late in the program to make sure that we didn't probably miss out on some of the mistakes we made the previous cup, where we basically ran out of headroom and development of the boat. So it was all kind of planned that these things were going to come late. But as it is, you don't have time to sail and test and then say, okay, we're going to use this component, because the period where you would be testing, you're locked into to measurement, because you're in the round robins or you're in the final semi-final. So you put things on the boat for only been doing a couple of days sailing, and like all of these things, it takes a little bit of time to get used to. You put a rudder on that's 100 meters shallower depth, and then all of a sudden the thing's cavitating more, the thing's stalling more, or the flight controller's worried about sailing at his normal trim because he's worried about losing the rudder. So you end up, even though the components are expected to be faster and the boat's meant to be going quicker, because of the way you're sailing the boat, you don't have as much confidence in the boat as you had before, you take a step backwards. But sometimes you've got to take a step backwards to step forwards, and it's a really, really tricky one to get right. And I think if it's flat water, then it's easy, because it's, you kind of know where you're at with the new stuff as soon as you're in waves, and the conditions are harder than what you'd sailed in the week before, and you make decisions to speed up the boat, then it's hard.
Yeah. You talk about the waves. Barcelona created a really unusual set of conditions, didn't it? There were times when it was with the kind of southerly, it was nice, flattish water. And then as soon as the breeze went anywhere that wasn't south, it changed completely. Can you describe those kind of cross swell conditions, what it's like to be sailing the boat, well, racing the boat, in fact?
It's a really interesting one. I remember we'd sail and rip around Pensacola Bay in that glass flat water, and you would be amazed how easy the boat was to sail. It was like it was on autopilot. And then we'd go outside into the waves and you'd be like, wow, this is a completely different game. And you then have to change the way you control the boat, the way you fly the boat and manage the boat. Once you're sailing in the flat water, it's like any other boat. You have plenty of time to look around and make these decisions. But as soon as you then get into the waves, initially you have to focus so much internally on just making sure the boat's sailing well. It's a challenge. But then obviously we spent enough time in Barcelona to get better and better and better at sailing the boat. So you spend more time with your eyes out actually being able to race. And you look across at some of the other teams, and it's definitely apparent how some boats were easier to sail. You can hear from the comms on the board that the guys are more focused into the racing, and certain boats are more talking about sailing the boat. And that's definitely something that some of the teams did very well last time, and something to definitely learn from going forward.
Yeah, and I think really you're referring specifically there to the Kiwis. Everybody's noticed the fact that they seem to be having a lovely afternoon race around the bay. I remember one race with Ben and Dylan, Ben kind of screaming about he couldn't get the heel on us, you know, something. It was some tricky moment on the boat, whereas Pete and Nathan were picking the next shift. How did they achieve that? They're not allowed to automate, but it seemed like the boat was almost sailing itself.
I think that's just their systems. They did such an amazing job of the system. It's funny, you chat to them afterwards over a couple of beers and try and drag out as much information as you can. But those Kiwis are pretty good at being tight-lipped and not giving too much away. But you can see and you hear about how four guys are able to communicate about racing. And then you see the other boats where two or three guys are communicating about how to sail the boat, and one guy's more communicating about the racing of the boat. So you take your hats off to them. They did a pretty good job of how setting the boat up to sail, but also the sailors did an amazing job of sailing the boat. And you know, it's just don't get given that equipment. You've got to develop it. And it's whoever does that the best. And they did a fantastic job of that.
Going back to the American Magic campaign, your experience with them the first time around for you and the second time around, it looked like quite a different campaign in many ways. I mean, there were many things that were the same, many people, consistency in there, but it felt different. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it was a very different campaign. I think with all these things, the new teams and the having a first go around at it, it's not easy. And you learn from your mistakes and you learn from your experience. And the first time around, the team was new to it all. And we had a lot of experienced people in there, but you just finding your feet and learning to work with each other. And you look at the last campaign, you've got another 3-4 years under the belt of working together. You got a similar core group of people in the team, and it's definitely a lot more efficient. I'm not saying it was perfect, because it definitely wasn't. There's a lot we can learn and get better at, but it was definitely a much better campaign when you from the inside, and I think from the outside too. It's just unfortunate again that certain incidents played a part, I guess, on the outcome.
Has there been a debrief yet? Is that something that happened straight away?
There was a lot of debriefing as soon as it finished. It was one thing that's so special about American Magic is how involved Doug DeVos is. He's the heart and soul of the team. He's the guy that drives everything forward, and he's so interested of what happens, how to make it better, and what he can do to help. And Doug was heavily involved with the debrief. Everybody was debriefed, and I'm sure it's still be an ongoing process.
Can you remember what your kind of key input into that was? What sort of things did you focus on?
I don't want to give too much away. It was more about identifying the areas that we did well and the areas that we didn't do so well at, and the things that we need to focus on last time. But it's also looking at the other teams. It's not just judging yourself by your own standards, but judging yourself against what the other teams did and trying to learn a little bit about their processes and what they did better or worse. And again, I think the biggest thing that stands out to me was just how well certain teams developed their boats. And I guess I'm talking about Ineos mainly. You look where they were at the Christmas Cup back in Auckland and where they ended up. And then again, you look at them this time of where they started off and where they finished off. And there's a big lesson, I guess, for all the teams, is that we all know, but you where you finish, you're not where you start, that makes a difference. And being able to react and change things to get the performance you need. And again, take my hats off to the Ineos guys. They did an amazing job to get from where they were to where they ended up again. They're obviously very good at that.
How much do you think the involvement of the Mercedes operation impacted that?
To be honest, I'm not sure. You never know unless you're on the inside. It that could well have been a part of why they started where they were. As well as why they finished where they were, you never know. It's one of those things that they obviously invested heavily in the performance tools of their development and recording everything. Like, you see every time the boat went out, there's a new sensor on here or sensor on there or somewhere else, and it's just like, wow, are they just getting confused in the weeds, or are they gathering data that's going to make the difference? And you never know. But they did a fantastic job of getting from where they were to where they finished at the end.
You've been teammates with Ben over the years. So once they were through and into the final, were you were supporting them at that point?
It's hard because you always want to be neutral. I was just gutted that American Magic didn't win, to be honest, with all the time and effort. But then I obviously have so many friends there, and I have so many friends in the Italian camp as well. So you try and be as neutral as you can. But obviously I don't think I've ever felt as happy seeing some of my childhood friends do so well as they did. And it was strange because I've never felt like that in sport about anybody else winning. And to feel that way while you watch those guys succeed was kind of nice, to be honest.
Yeah. It's hard not to be swayed by Freddie Carr with both arms in the air screaming as they cross the the line to win the Louis Vuitton Cup. That was a magic moment, I thought.
That's definitely one of the images of the Cup.
I think so. Let's talk about the dual helming role. The Italians introduced that in AC36, and everybody has seen the light, followed on. In many ways, it just seems like a no-brainer because there's nobody running across the boat, all of that good stuff. But it raises a real challenge of communication and coordination between the two helmsmen on the boat. Can you talk a bit about the challenges of that?
Yeah, there's heaps of challenges. I think the one thing we kind of looked at, I guess, the previous cup was the guy only gets half the amount of time practicing steering, or half the amount of time. And you know, there's a huge downside. And then you saw how well that Francesco and Jimmy did it. And you're like, wow, we missed that by a long way. And it's a challenge because you're there half the time, you're driving the boat, half your time you're trimming and then giving input to the other side. The hardest bit is to be on the same page, because all of us are extremely talented sailors and hardly any of us see the thing exactly the same. Like there's always a slight, the snapshot of the picture is always slightly different from one person's eyes to the other person's eyes. And it's making sure you're all on the same page. And the hardest bit is the communication, choosing the words you need that work well with your teammate on the other side. But it's a huge challenge, but it's also very rewarding. Like when you're sailing the boat well and you're both in alignment with a plan and it's going well, it's incredibly rewarding. But then it's also incredibly frustrating when you're not doing as well and you miss a couple of things and you then got to battle back. But it's fun and it's not easy.
Yeah, I'm thinking as much about American Magic as with Ineos, Ben brought Dylan in. And certainly in the early races, it was taking some time to bed in that relationship between just how much Ben would, I don't know if trust is the right word, but it's such a fine balance. I thought Dylan did an amazing job of just keeping firing the information that he had kind of into the comms loop. And eventually there seemed to be a subtle change at some point where it started to gel. Did you see that?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of that's down to confidence as well. Like initially you're there in a racing environment and you're just trying to do your job well. And then you get confident in your role and you get better at it. And then you got more bandwidth to start adding more. And the more confidence you get, the more you grow and the more information you feed. I definitely saw that with the Ineos team this time.
There's an obvious question to ask. Tom was your opposite number, Tom Slingsby. You were fierce rivals in the laser class back in the day. It's the stuff of legend, really. How much of a challenge was that side of things? I mean, I know during the Cup you said, yeah, we've put it all behind us and we're just focused on this now. But in reality, was it more difficult because you used to be such fierce rivals?
It wasn't easy, for sure. Like, but we did a pretty good job of highlighting that early on and working through the way we operate and work together. Like we worked with a psychologist together. We had meetings regularly about making sure we were on track and going the right way and getting better. And we had a really good support team around us helping us. So I think like you see from the racing as we got better and better, the comms got better and better in it, but it was always a work in progress. But I think as for putting the old stuff behind us, that was pretty easy. We were mates years ago and then we were rivals and then it's easy to be mates when you're on the same team. So that to me wasn't a real issue. The hardest bit is always trying to see things through the same lens, the situations, because you see in sail GP with 10, 12 boats, it's very much reacting. So it's, you don't really need to communicate. It's just a very much reactional. Whereas in the America's Cup, it's very much more about, match racing and having one boat and having a plan. So being able to adjust from one to the other and being on the same page as each other was the biggest challenge. But then you work in the simulator for hours and hours and you go through set plays and then you get to see what the other person's seeing, and they get to see what you're seeing, and then you come up with, okay, this is going to be the default from now. This is how we're going to approach that problem. So you're both on the same page. And yeah, it was hard work, but it was also rewarding as well.
Are you interested in advertising your product or service on the Yacht Racing Life podcast? It's really simple. Go to yachtracinglife.com/advertising to find out how. Yeah, it's interesting that that simulator time must have been so useful. The simulators obviously are advancing all the time. How different was the simulation setup for you this time compared with last time?
Oh, it was a huge difference. Like last time we looked back to Auckland, you'd almost compare it as a PlayStation game and as opposed to a virtual reality game. This time around, they were miles apart, and it was a huge thing that we brought up in the debrief from Auckland that we were a long way behind where we need to be on this. So a lot of time and effort was invested into developing the simulator to the point where it got to a very very useful tool, especially for the race practice and the comps practice going into racing this time.
For those of us who haven't seen the simulator, can you kind of describe it? Don't obviously you're not going to give anything away, anything top secret. But is it a room? Is it a desk? Is it a computer?
We just had a container, and in the container it was set up to mimic the boat using all the same HIDs and 3D goggles and sail the boat as if you would in real life.
HIDs.
Human interface devices. So it's a way of developing the things on the boat. So you want a new wheel, you want the buttons in a different place. You first test it out in the simulator to make sure you're happy with it and make sure you're happy with the mapping and where you put your fingers. And it's all about just getting used to your device you use and comfortable with it, so that day one it goes on the water, you don't need to look at it. Like the hardest bit last time round without the simulator is you have a controller with 15, 16 buttons on it, and you get very used to where they are without looking at it. And then you add some more functions or change the layout, and you spend the first couple of days visualizing where they are as opposed to it just being second nature. So that side of things, I'm sure it's the same with all the teams, is extremely useful.
Did you each have custom steering wheels?
Yeah, we had our own different setups. We tried for a while to have the buttons in the same place and have the same controls, but like everything, it's very much a bespoke personal preference, and so the steering wheels were different.
So put us in the cockpit of the boat when you're sailing. What are you looking at? In your laser, you'd be looking at the waves, you'd be looking at the telltales and the compass. What are you looking at in an AC-75?
It's very different, but the basics are very much the same. You're down so low in the cockpit that it's basically your eye level is split between an array of screens. And on those screens can be anything from cameras that give you different views of the boat, whether that be looking forward, looking sideways, looking backwards, or looking at foils. And then you have all your displays, which give you a lot of the loads of each function on the boat. It gives you how much power that's available from the grinders or how much is stored in the accumulator. And then you've also got your tactical screen with the course, where you are on the course, and you've got a whole array of buttons to control 101 things and dials that can adjust the ratios on a lot of stuff in front of you. And then again, the primary focus while you're sailing is you're trying to look out as much as you can. You have an abundance of information, but my primary focus a lot of the time was just on the breeze coming out the boat in front of you and on the looking at the jib to try and sail as much as normal as you possible. But you're always kind of splitting your vision between the reality in the sky above the boat and then the array of screens you have down below. It's almost like you need your eyes to look in different positions if you could.
And the goggles that you're wearing, the helmet, the visors, those are custom built for you?
Yeah. So you have the ability to see things if you do so wish in your goggles.
Oh, is it like a heads up display?
Yeah, I'm not giving too much.
Yeah, okay. I'll accept your answer on that one. Now, the AC40 was a big part of this cup, and particularly with you guys, you had the two boats, and as part of my recon role, I watched a lot of the sparring that went on between those two American boats. It looked like tremendous fun. What can you tell us about that AC40 class?
Oh, it's amazing. I remember we first sailed the boat in Pensacola, and it was so much fun. And then within a couple of weeks, like, okay, when's the next one coming? We can't come soon enough. And then I think we were so lucky of choosing the pathway to go down the 40s for the foil testings. We could basically have identical boats and do a great job of testing foils or testing sails. But the most fun part was the racing. I look back to I think we had a 3-month block in Barcelona when we first arrived, which was pretty much solely focused on racing 40s against each other. It was some of the most fun sailing I've ever done in my life. Some of the best bits were we'd always finish the day if we could with a short tacking race up the shore back to the base, and you'd get in 20, maybe more tacks, and you'd work your way all the way up from the smokestacks back to the harbor entrance. And it was so good for the racing skills and so good for the team.
Yeah, I remember watching those sessions and thinking how much fun they were. And it also made me think about, you know, if this turns into a class, an owner's class maybe, or just a pro class, you know, maybe the racing could also be kind of coastal racing as well, because you don't need to be on a windward-leeward course with these boats, really.
No, you could sail a few more miles. Obviously, you got the batteries that are going to hold you back at some point, but there's plenty of opportunity. I remember some of the youth delivered our boat down to Villanova, and they were desperate to try and sail it the whole way. It was an hour and a half in the car, so it would have been a fun sail down.
What do you think is the future of that class? Have you had any involvement in that?
No, not really. I've had Luca's obviously pushing to try and get the class up and running. I think it'd be a fantastic class, even with owners to drive. Quite often, Doug DeVos, who was at the base, is out in the chase, and we'd take him for a ride. And he's an incredible sailor, Doug. Like he puts it on that he's not that good, but he was helming one of the 40s on the offside to me on a couple of days where we'd do some racing and straight lining, and the smile on his face every time you stopped. I think we were there during the 52 regatta in Barcelona, and we were just doing laps around the outside of the 52s at 40 plus knots. And the thrill and I guess it's still sailing, and the satisfaction you get from sailing the boat well is immense. And I think there's a huge opportunity for a lot more people to experience these amazing boats. Like, we are so lucky and privileged that we get to go out and sail these incredible boats and sail at 50 knots and go at wind at 30, 40 knots. And so many people never get the opportunity to do this. Hopefully the class works and it gives other people that maybe don't get this opportunity to go out there and try it and be as lucky as we are to experience this sort of stuff.
And the 40s we use for the youth and the women's America's Cups, two really standout events in this cycle. What was your view? You must have been watching that race, and it looked amazing.
Well, I was quite jealous that we weren't able to go and do some more fleet racing. Like it was amazing that we got the opportunity to do the World Series events before. It's just a shame there wasn't more of them. And then to watch the women and youth, like, it was really impressive to see how well they did with so little time in the boats, and to obviously the time in the simulator had served them well, but you just saw the learning curves and how much they were developing. And the cup teams had got a bit of a jump on all the other teams, but you could see the other teams progressing so much faster and closing the gap through the gatta, which was really cool to watch. And again, I think that style and format of racing is a great way to showcase these boats and to give the women and the youth an opportunity to go and do their thing.
You think it's a good way in for as a feeder for full America's Cup teams? Because we saw Artemis there, some good friends of yours, I'm sure, in that team from your time with Artemis. It made me wonder whether, you know, we're going to see a full campaign from them at some point.
I'm sure that's definitely at the back of their minds. It's, I think the 40 is a great class to introduce sailors into this sort of sailing, but it's not only the sailors, it's the support staff, the coaches, the performance analysis. They have hydraulics guys, electronics guys. It's just a great way to get introduced into these sort of boats and to what's needed.
Where do you see the possibility for new teams for the Cup next cycle?
It's really hard because you don't know until the rules are announced. I think what makes it very difficult for some of the new teams is the nationality rule. It's obviously very difficult if you're from certain countries where it's a little bit, you need experience on these boats. Like for sure, it's a youthful class and the youth are definitely the future of these boats coming through, but you need to have experience shortcuts a lot of the pitfalls and saves you a lot of time at some point. And some new teams, if you're not allowed some experience in there, it's tricky. I think the Swiss did a good job of getting to where they were, but you obviously saw the challenges that team had without having any previous sailors from the previous cycle. So to be honest, I'm not really sure. I think it's hard. It's always hard for new teams because you look at the guys who've been doing it for 10 years more, and you look at Team New Zealand, Luna Rossa, Ineos, they've all got 10 years of experience behind them. And every campaign, the team gets stronger and it's worked with their core group for another 3 years, 4 years. So they get better, they get more efficient. And it's always a challenge as the new kids on the block to go out and compete. But that's also something that's fun. Like, it's nice to try and go and beat the experienced ones.
Yeah. And just remind me, Paul, you're able to sail for the Americans because in a previous cup, the rules were different about nationality. So you're kind of grandfathered into it.
Yeah, the way it worked in Auckland, I can't remember what it was. You had to do a certain number of days in country to qualify. And then the rules for the last cup, if you'd sailed for the team the previous cup, you were allowed to sail again. So again, it a little bit depends on how they write the rules to what's available.
I guess, and the chat I've had with other journalists is that it's unlikely that Grant Dalton's going to relax the nationality rule very much, given that there'll be if he did, there were potential for a massive raiding party for all his talent. It's understandable. But I wonder, does it make it almost an unattainable goal that people are going to look, say, well, I fancy a crack at the America's Cup, and then realize that the dominance of the Kiwis just makes it a waste of time? Or is participating in the Cup enough?
I don't think any of these teams compete to compete like this. They're huge organizations with people who are winners, and everyone wants to win. You don't go into these things to compete. I certainly don't. I don't think a lot of the people on our team do. You go in there because you want to win. But then you've also got to be, when you look at this sort of thing, you're like, wow, it is a huge mountain to climb. To try and beat the Kiwis who have got this jump on everybody. But it's, I think the gap closed from last time. And I think if the rules are along similar lines to what they were this time, I think the gap will close again. But I think that gap's only going to close with the existing teams who've got the IP and the knowledge. It's for new teams coming in, it's not going to be easy. But then it's also a cool challenge, to get your teeth into.
What are you hearing about the potential for changes to the boat, to the rules for next time around? It's going to be the 75 again, but will it look different? Will we still have cyclos, do you think?
It really, again, comes down to the rules. If they want to keep the numbers of sailors on the boat down, then I think we'd definitely be seeing cyclos again. If they open it up and happy to have more people on board, then it opens up the grinding. But I can only see it staying kind of in the way it is. And then you hear vicious rumors about what's going to happen. But again, Don't try and waste too much energy on listening to those until you hear what it's actually going to be.
What would your choice be? I'll give you my version of it. I would get rid of the cyclos completely and have more sailors, have more people doing things on the boat. I think that from a spectator point of view would be much more entertaining to watch.
It's a really interesting one. I think from a sailor's standpoint, it's bloody hard being a cycler. And if you could just put batteries on and have more sailors on, I think that'd be way better for the sailors and be probably, I don't know if it'd be better for the racing, because it'd mean the boats would be easier to race if there's more people able to focus on their jobs without limited power. I think one of the real challenges, which excites me as well, is the system side. Like, developing a system that allows you to sail the boat a bit better than the other guy. Like, at the end of the day, you look at all the athletes on all the teams, and they're all incredible athletes, and they can all put out a similar sort of amount of power for 20 minutes. It's how you use that power, and you can make your system 20, 30% more efficient than you can make a guy 20, 30% fitter. So, like, internally behind closed doors, which people don't see, it's a huge challenge and an opportunity to develop these systems and make the boats better that way. And that bit, I was really into that, and probably more so in the New Zealand Cup being the trimmer, because you're using more of the systems. But even this time around, it's fascinating and it's challenging and it's awesome to do. So I think from the inside point, I kind of like that side of things, and also having another group of 10 sailors who are going to basically lay themselves on the sword every day for you to try and get the boat around the track. It develops an awesome atmosphere and a lot of camaraderie, and you build really strong friendships with the guys pushing the watts for you. So I kind of like that, but then I can also see from a spectator side, seeing from a sailor side as well, having unlimited batteries like you do in the 40s is pretty good fun. It makes the boat easier to sail and more maneuverable, but it loses a little bit of the, I guess, the systems and the development race in that side of things.
Okay. Let's see how it all pans out. Now the teams are kind of on hiatus right now while we wait for the new rule. But what does that look like in reality? Because it's hard for people to understand these 100, 150, 200 people teams suddenly just get mothballed. Everybody goes home. How do you protect the IP? How do you maintain some continuity through to the next campaign?
The easiest way is to be the challenger record, I think, because then you're able to give direction to where you want to be, and you know who you need to hire, and you're part of it all. It's very hard when you're not the challenger and you're waiting to see what card you're dealt, and then you also don't know whether that's going to align with the owners, if they're going to want to keep going, if it's not in a place they want to be, or it's not in a boat they want to be involved with. So it's really, really difficult. And again, this is one of the areas, I think, where the defender and the challenger record get a little bit of an advantage in this sort of period. So it's not easy.
From your position personally, is there another cup in you? And would it be with American Magic?
Oh, I'd love to be involved again, either with American Magic or another team. I think the boats are incredible. I love the racing and I love the whole design race that becomes part of it. But for now, like my focus at the minute has been a nice couple of months spending time with my family. And then I've just been involved with the Brazilian Sail GP team in Dubai, and I'll be doing a little bit more with those guys throughout this next year.
Are you going to be coaching or sailing?
I can't really tell you, to be honest, right now. I was asked to go to the last event, and I spent the time in the booth, which was really insightful. I'd never been sat in the booth watching the racing and kind of spectating on the race like that. And then with the way that the team's set up with a six man, so to speak, there's an opportunity there. But again, it's whatever's best for the team, and we haven't kind of decided what it's going to be going forward.
SailGP looks really appealing this season. It's really exciting for the spectators, and it seems to be where the pro sailors want to be.
No, I think it's fun racing. It's definitely very different from the cup stuff. Like I think what it misses is the design and the development. But then you look at it this time, the T-foils are coming on board in Auckland, which is great because it means that the more established teams maybe have to step back and learn things again. And the new teams are learning things for the first time. So again, thinking for the Brazilians and our team at the moment, it's a great opportunity to learn. And we've got some fantastic people to learn those skills quickly.
Yeah. And you've got that opportunity with all that shared data nobody can have an advantage for long because it's people are ferreting all over it in between regattas, right?
Again, that's just something else that blows my mind is that, hey, you can look live what some of the other guys are doing, never mind post-processing. And we talked about in the cup how the teams have learned the quickest, and it's exactly the same, I think, in the SailGP arena.
Now, you were telling me before we started the call, you've been able to spend some time with your family while you've been recuperating, and you're having to learn Italian. Your wife is Italian, and your youngster is Italian too. So how's that going?
That's not going as well as it should be doing. To be honest, I'm a bit scared now that my little man's in Italian school and he's coming home speaking a lot more Italian. I'm desperately trying to pick up my pieces, and I've got to work on my game to get to his level.
All right. Well, Paul, I'll let you get off to your Italian lessons. Thanks so much for taking the time. It's been really interesting, as I knew it would be.
No problem. Thanks, Justin.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview. But in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.